This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Colorado, Denver, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figdor, Robert Talese, and Malcolm Keating. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Lindsay Stewart, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the University of Memphis. Her book, The Politics of Black Joy, Zora Neale Hurston, and Neo-Abolitionism, is just out from Northwestern University Press. What can Southern Black Joy teach us about agency? What role does refusal have in liberation? What more might there be to root work than resistance? In The Politics of Black Joy, Stewart explores Hurston's contributions to political theory and philosophy of race to develop a politics of joy that owes much to indifference, refusal, and tactical misrecognition. Contending with white supremacy and countering neo-abolitionist approaches that reduce Southern Black life to tales of tragedy, Stewart suggests how a politics of Black joy can broaden our imaginations to think emancipation anew. Lindsay Stewart, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here today. So will you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and about your background as a theorist and how you came to write this book on Zora Neale Hurston's work and the role of joy?
Okay. I guess one way to start would be that I'm from Louisiana, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I think that if anyone asks me today, you know, where are you from? I'll still say Louisiana, even though now I live in Memphis and I've lived in a couple of places in the United States since being raised in Louisiana. And one of the things that always kind of struck out to me being from Louisiana is when I went to school up north in Michigan and in Pennsylvania, I noticed there was this mismatch between how people talked about Black life in the South and how I actually lived it being from the South. And there was this sort of disdain, and wariness about me wanting to move back to the South. There was this sense that why would I want to do that? It's so horrible down there. There's so much racism. The Ku Klux Klan is always out. And that was there. But there didn't seem to be room in those conversations for a lot of the resources that I found growing up in the South, in Black communities. And it was almost as if it was looked down upon to say anything really good about Black life in the South. So a lot of this book and my research in general comes out of that mismatch of how in the U.S. we tend to talk about Black life in the South, and how I lived it and how my mother and grandmother lived it and what I witnessed in terms of our rituals, our ways of making meaning and the fullness of our lives. Zora Neale Hurston gave me the language to talk about that mismatch and theorize it. So that's where Zora Neale Hurston comes into this. I hadn't planned on spending so much time on working on Zora Neale Hurston, but once I found her in my third year of graduate school, I never quite was able to get rid of her. And she's someone that I wrestle with and admire, and she's really pushed me to think about how Black life in the South gets portrayed in the U.S. public sphere.
Yeah, and this, I think, is a really nice setup for talking about the actual structure of the book, because before each chapter, you write a scene. And I was hoping you could talk in general about what the relationship between those scenes and the chapters, what that relationship is.
So I was really influenced by a recent book by Imani Perry called Vexy Thing on Gender and Liberation. And in that book, it just came out in, I think, 2018 or 2019. In that book, she has a lot of the theoretical work that she's doing in the chapters, but then she also has what she calls interludes that talk about, I guess, the application, real life application. So she delves into the history of witches and how witches relate to the larger arguments she's making about gender liberation, and what are some of the hopes and also failures of this project of feminism throughout the centuries in the U.S. I loved that setup. And one of the things I loved about that setup and that I tried to emulate in my own book is that it made the book a lot more readable. If you weren't an academic, you could still pick up those interludes and get something very rich out of them. So that was also something that I was aiming towards, was I wanted to make it very digestible for people who maybe aren't even in philosophy. Another thing that I was drawn to with the interludes and what I tried to emulate in my own book is that I felt like this was one way to prepare the reader for my argument. So give the reader a concrete example of what I'm talking about. And that prepares them for the sort of move that I'm trying to make in my analysis of Zora Neale Hurston's essays. I guess maybe a third reason of why I went this way is because most of my arguments are about Zora Neale Hurston's essays in the book. To some degree, I talk a little bit about her autobiography, but I was very intentional about focusing my argument on her essays. And I did so because a lot of Black feminists, most of their theoretical work is in essays, sort of like how philosophers used to write treatises. And I worry about how sometimes, because Zora Neale Hurston was also a novelist, that we tend to focus on drawing the philosophy out of her novels to the exclusion of her essays. So I wanted to focus on her essays. And those interludes in the book, or those scenes, are my essays kind of contributing to this tradition of writing theoretical work in essays or essay form.
Yeah, that they were really enjoyable to read. They were really nice. They created a really nice flow to the book where you sort of come out of a chapter and then you have, as you're saying, an interlude or the scene. and then you return to the argument, there's a really nice rhythm to it.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah. Well, and I love thinking of them as essays within the book too. That's rich. Yeah. So let's get into the argument. Your reading of Hurston's performance of Southern Black Joy is a response to this well-entrenched dialectic of Black enchantment and Black tragedy, is one way that you talk about it. And so would you help us understand the nature of that dialectic and sort of what the underlying logic of it is?
So one way to go about it is to kind of know about Hurston's own life, is that a lot of what she wrote, especially in essays, just seemed to strike the wrong notes in the public sphere, especially in progressive anti-racist circles. And she caused so much discord in her essays that in some ways she was kind of outcasted during her lifetime. I was trying to make sense of that. What exactly was she doing? Because it seemed like in some ways a lot of her positions on things like racism and feminism aligns with the more progressive way of thinking about these issues. So how do we make sense of those moments when she seems to be contradicting that? I did not want to read her as just a woman who got confused or who was just trying to be provocative just for its own sake. And reading her essays led me to really see that there were these ways of reading Black life that were pretty predominant in the period of enslavement and the antebellum abolitionist period. These weren't the only ways, but they were pretty predominant. So one way was to read Black life in the South as perfectly normal and okay. Black people are happy being slaves. And look, we're so much more productive when we're under white control, under white rule. That was the argument that was set forth by slave owners during this period where the issue of slavery was coming to a head in the public sphere. The other way of reading Black life in the South was to emphasize how horrible slavery was and how much we did not enjoy it and how much we wanted to be free. And that sort of argument was put forward by abolitionists during the time. And what's interesting to me is that when you have these two different ways of looking at Black life in the South as predominant, some things drop out or you can't really say. So because these ways of Black life were shaped by an argument in the public sphere about whether slavery was moral or not, there were certain questions or aspects of Black life that, should you mention them, would put you on the wrong side politically. So for people who really didn't agree with the idea that slavery was okay, for those people, they really did not want to say anything about whether Black people had moments of being happy while they were enslaved, if they had moments where their lives weren't overshadowed by terrible white slave masters. And I'm very sympathetic to that. You can understand why you just don't want to have anyone saying those sorts of things at that moment if you're on the side of the abolitionist saying, we want to completely abolish slavery. Those methods or ways of talking about Black life in the South continued even after the abolition of slavery. So you have someone like Zora Neale Hurston during the Reconstruction period, just a generation or two out from slavery, saying, how am I supposed to talk about Black life in its fullness if the only lines that are dictated to me that I can take are, we enjoyed slavery and we were happy, or slavery was awful and there's nothing good that you can see in Black life because of it.
Yeah, and part of Hurston's performance of A Politics of Joy, you argue, is indifference to racism, and you read that indifference as a mode of refusal. Will you talk about what it means to read that indifference as a mode of refusal?
Yeah, so one of the ways to kind of get at it is to see that both sides of this way of shaping the discourse on Black life in the South does have a inner logic that they share. Both sides are preoccupied with Black-white relationships, and both sides seem to share this sense that Black life will go awry without white intervention. So you have on the side of the slave owners this sense that Black life, in order to be at its most productive, must have white control. But you also have white abolitionists who are very invested in intervening in what's happening in the South, as if Black people could not get free without their intervention. And Hurston took exception to this idea that all of Black life is directed towards white people, or preoccupied with white people, or concerned with white people. So that's what I mean by how often she chose indifference instead. She tried to live as though white people were not our major concern and were not the center of our lives. And sometimes that comes out as a refusal. And this is part of why she struck such notes of discord in the public sphere is, I think today, and this is something that comes out of the abolitionist discourse that is still with us today. If you want to be seen as progressive, there are some norms with how you talk about Black life in the public sphere. And one of those norms is that it's always in terms of tragedy, of how devastating our racism makes our lives. And it's because you don't want to be mistaken for someone who is conservative who would say Black people are fine and there's no racism whatsoever. I think that's a false dichotomy, and I think Hurston saw that. And she chose instead to reject this abolitionist norm of only talking about the tragedy of Black life, or during her time, only talking about the crisis of lynching, and instead choosing to focus on areas of Black joy, or areas where Black people were in conversation with each other and not so concerned about what white people are doing.
Yeah, and part of how you play this out is through your reading of Hurston's disagreements with Du Bois and the way Du Bois reads spirituals and labels them sorrow songs. And you read Hurston's rejection of that label as a rejection of new abolitionist framings, and particularly of Black people as objects of pity. You've got that chapter title. And so I would love you to flesh this out about how does this disagreement allow us to see Hurston as responding to Du Bois, right? And about the nature of things like some of the things you talk about are like the nature of racial progress, the role of root work, and the role of cultural assimilation in political struggles.
Mm-hmm. So before I begin to answer this question, I just want to like preface it with, this was one of the hardest chapters for me to write, because I know that everyone loves Du Bois, and you know, I do respect and admire him. But I do think that it's his model of politics that kind of went out in these battles and shapes African-American philosophy, or the canon of African-American philosophy. So it was important to put Hurston and Du Bois in conversation. That being said, my focus was on the souls of Black folk. So for those Du Bois scholars who are out there listening, this is not about later Du Bois. This is primarily about the souls of Black folk, because that's the only book that I'm aware of Hurston reading by Du Bois. And there's, you know, textual evidence of Hurston not only knowing Du Bois, exchanging letters with him, but also writing about him in her own essays. And she's focused on Du Bois because the way that he positions himself is as kind of an inheritor of the tradition of abolitionism that Frederick Douglass was such a huge developer of. So I decided with this chapter to focus on the essay that Hurston wrote called Spirituals and Neo-Spirituals, where some of her most direct criticisms of Du Bois are present. I see the spirituals as an entryway into different modes of politics that Hurston and Du Bois go after. So one way to think about the difference between them is that the model of politics that Du Bois takes up through his analysis of the spirituals is one of the politics of recognition. You can see this in some of the ways that he talks about the main message that the spirituals are giving. It's a message of justice in the liberal sense, and by liberal, I mean philosophical liberal sense of one day being judged by our character and not our skins. He also takes up an interpretation of the spirituals that is first put forth by Frederick Douglass, to where the spirituals become a weapon of abolitionism. And the way that you're supposed to understand spirituals, according to Douglass and then Du Bois, is that they're a testament to the evils of slavery. So they're evidence of the abolitionist cause. Hurston thinks this is just false. She thinks that, you know, there are places where, sure, the spirituals do testify to misery and woe of the slaves. But by and large, Hurston thinks that the spirituals have nothing to do with slavery, that you can find songs that count as spirituals that are about a whole bunch of topics, judgment, death, love. It's not just about this altercation with white slave owners for her. So I call kind of her model of politics a politics of refusal, because she refuses that abolitionist line that you can reduce Black life to our struggle against white people.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me about in that chapter, I think, yeah, it was there that just this point, from Hurston that you underline, which is that spirituals are so much a part of everyday life. This song making is so much a part of everyday life that they can be forgotten, right? That they're like all the time being made and all the time being forgotten. And there was something so important, I think, about the level of Hurston's concern with like everyday life and the relationships, the like relationships Black people have with themselves and with each other and the everydayness of that, that she is trying to, like to give life to in many ways in her work. And so I just loved that point about that there's so much part of everyday life that we forget them, right? That we make them and then we forget them.
She also, I'm glad you brought that up because she also contests that the spirituals were just something confined to the period of enslavement. Yeah. So she's very much so wants to say, look, it's slavery has been abolished and we're still producing the spirituals, which is another point to how it wasn't just about slavery, the spirituals message, that the message of the spirituals has a lot to do with the idea of the sacred in Black life. And how the sacred can be found in the mundane, everyday aspects of life.
Yeah. Well, and part of what you give us an account of, and it looks like this was maybe a lifelong tendency that then becomes an occupation of her intellectual life is how much Hurston seemed to revel in elements of Black culture and. I think about the scene in the jazz club that you describe and that she describes, and that she part of how she develops that reveling into a methodology is through her relationship with an interviewee, Casola. Is that
Casola?
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And you really help us think about that relationship with her interviewee through another ethnographer, through Audra Simpson's work. And this really seems to animate what you mean by refusal, right? Is that, is what Audra Simpson is up to. Will you tell us more, I guess, about, how refusal helps us understand this relationship and how this relationship helps develop, Hurston's own approach to things like misrecognition, refusal, indifference.
Yeah, I mean, this was my favorite chapter.
Yeah.
Partly because I have been following Audra Simpson for a while now, and I absolutely love her work. And I found in her work conceptual tools like the way that she talks about refusal as a way of understanding how Hurston's politics really did not follow a politics of recognition. If anything, it was, I want them to not recognize me so that I can be left alone. And that really resonated with me. There are some ways that Hurston also suggests a comparison of kind of Black life and Native American life and politics that arise out of those different sorts of oppressions in her letters and some of her essays. One of her most famous essays, Court Order Can't Make Races Mix, where she denounces Brown versus Board. I mean, that essay got her in a lot of trouble. But her defense of her position was to say that she takes, quote, the Indian position over the line that many Black people were expected to take, which was, you know, gratitude to the Supreme Court for making white people integrate with us. She did not like the sense of pity that she felt girded the Supreme Court decision. So you can see how she got into a lot of trouble with that essay. But I think, you know, her referring to the Indian position also gave me a clue as to, okay, so maybe she's getting something out of Native American politics that she couldn't get out of African American politics during that time. So one of the things that, I get out of Audra Simpson is this really rich conceptual analysis of practices of refusal. And I try to figure out how that might work or map out in Black life, because there are some really stark differences between African American life and Native American life, especially when you think about the history of slavery and how that issue played out differently across various groups. So it's not a straight comparison. There are lots of ways in which it doesn't map on. But one of the ways that it seems to map on for Hurston is the sense that she felt that Native Americans did not push the U.S. to integrate. She felt that they had a tradition of self-respect that meant that they did not see themselves as pitiful, and they would not let the U.S. see them in that way. And that's where Hurston kind of wants to go. Because of the tradition of abolitionism that informs Black writing, she has a lot of work to do to get away from viewing from this norm where we are viewed as objects of pity if we want to gain anything politically. So one way to think about, you know, how does she contort herself to get out of this is to think about how might the goals of Black writing shift if it's no longer about truth and revelation and more about misrecognition. It means that she can contradict herself. It means that she can play with the reader and tell them lies if she wants to. It means that there's a part of her that she's not willing to share with the audience, primarily because of her self-respect in the sense that she does not want to become an object of pity in her reader's eyes. She does not want to contribute to this kind of enjoyment that abolitionists and the descendants of abolitionists might have in consuming Black trauma, Black suffering, Black pain. So it means things like her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road, might actually not tell us very much about her. Mm. And she might tell us some lies in that autobiography. And she might say things that completely fly in the face of what we would expect of a Black writer during her time.
Yeah, it strikes me how difficult it is to read someone who's willing to use misrecognition and who's engaged in refusal.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things that I find most rewarding about reading Hurston. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a tendency sometimes to, especially when it comes to African-American writers, to feel that we can just read these thinkers in philosophy, that we can just read these thinkers straightforwardly without consideration of the historical context. And I think Hurston is one of those thinkers that, like so many others in the African-American kind of canon, you cannot do that with You can't just pick up a Hurston essay and teach it straightforwardly. You have to be aware of all of these different debates that inform African-American politics and philosophy to be able to teach her responsibly. So she kind of demands that you study her, and that when she says something, do not just take it at face value. Mm.
Yeah, it's one of the ways I saw you study her in the book was to return to her words, like to a passage in different ways, and that the same passage would come up in a new way. And it was really always so interesting to see the way that that passage would take on this new meaning in your your next reading of it, and that accumulates through the book.
Yeah, to some degree, I was trying to follow even her own conceptualization of Black aesthetics. So this is something that comes out of her essay Characteristics of Negro Expression. And it's something that's also taken up in Cheryl Wall's newest book, The Will to Adorn. And it's this, that is the concept, The Will to Adorn, the sense that there are these different registers of Black art, whether it be writing, sculpture, dancing. There is this tendency for adornment, many, many layers, and this, it creates this rich fullness of expression. Mm-hmm. And it isn't about resistance, or again, it isn't about kind of a address to white people. It's very self-referential. And that's one of the things that I was trying to do with Hurston's own words, because I think that she not only noticed that as an anthropologist, but also practiced that in her own writing. So yeah, a lot of her passages have these rich layers of meaning that you can tease apart in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and a certain playfulness, I think, and what's happening. Yeah, and it was striking to me just the way you also lay out a sort of Black feminist tradition of reading Hurston, that allows those readings, right? That sort of made her available over time because Black feminists did the work to keep reading her, right, and to see her playing and to see her. Yeah. Yeah, to see what she was up to.
I mean, Alice Walker especially, she's one of the people that is often mentioned in, you know, the recovery of Zora Neale Hurston. But it was also a lot of Black feminist teachers, honestly, who, there was one point when Hurston's novel, Their Eyes Are Watching God, was out of print. Wow. And it took a lot of school teachers who would just make copies of the one copy that they had of that book that kept us reading Hurston. I mean, of course, now you can find Their Eyes Are Watching God anywhere. But I don't want us to forget the number of teachers who made sure that their Black students still had access to Hurston.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the way you give us a glimpse into the work that of generations, right. That made this possible. And then the way that you connect her to Beyonce, right. Like you kind of give us, you kind of bridge the gap, the time gap there. We have not done full justice to the importance of Beyonce to your work here.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything more about that before we turn to your conclusion?
I mean, Beyoncé surprised me too. I wasn't really a Beyoncé fan. But then I listened to and watched the visual album Lemonade. I was like, oh, she's kind of serious. And I realized a lot of the ways that people kind of talk about Beyoncé is a little bit dismissive. Mm-hmm. And it struck me as dismissive in a similar way that people are dismissive of Hurston's racial politics. Right? So people are willing to accept that Hurston contributed a lot to feminist politics. But because of some of her stances on race that were out of step, like her denouncement of Brown versus Board, meant that people were kind of like, she wasn't really so serious about race though, or she profoundly misunderstood some things about race. I find a similar thing going on with the way that people kind of dismiss Beyoncé's intellect. Mm-hmm. And Lemonade was such an important resource for me because at least with that album, visual album, she is really trying to develop a Black Southern aesthetic. And the sort of politics that you get out of Lemonade, some of the racial politics, like her nods to Black Lives Matter, is firmly rooted in the Black South. So it was kind of the perfect example for me of how do you develop an appreciation of Southern Black joy today. How do you do that? What does that look like in the public sphere? And how do people respond to it in the public sphere?
Yeah. And so you've had a little time to think about Lemonade. Your conclusion does this thing that I always find really breathtaking, which is you read events unfolding, you read the pandemic unfolding through the analysis you've developed in the book. And I'll just say, like, when events unfolding, I'm usually sort of frozen in front of them. And then 5 years later, I have like a thought about how I might have a thought about that. So it really does. It's an amazing intervention, I think, in your conclusion and the way you're able to do it so quickly, like in the midst of the pandemic unfolding. So would you talk a little bit just about how your this work on the politics of Black joy did allow you to process the pandemic as it is unfolding, but especially as you were writing, it was pretty early, right? In the days of the pandemic.
Yeah, it was really early.
Yeah.
I think it was like the second wave or something, and now we're on our fourth wave. So
yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was really early. The resource that I got out of the book, you know, in writing the book was ways of analyzing how Black Southern life gets represented in the public sphere. So I thought a good test case would be how is Black Southern life being represented during a national crisis? International crisis, but yeah, in particular in the US, how is it being represented? And I found that in news reports, there was this sense that the pandemic was going to be worse in the South and that was just inevitable. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really caught my interest was reports from the New York Times about how Mardi Gras is to blame for the spike in New Orleans. And I just, you know, I had to sit with that for a bit to figure out what it was that bothered me about that. And one of the things that came out of me thinking about it was the sense that they blamed how bad the pandemic was in New Orleans. It was very bad in New Orleans right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because of a cultural tradition that really emphasizes Black joy. I mean, Mardi Gras is part of an international kind of festival, Carnival. And it's one of the few times in a year where you really get to see Black joy on display in New Orleans and in the Gulf Coast. I found it interesting that the reports blamed it on Mardi Gras and not on the number of Northern tourists that flooded the streets of New Orleans, especially those from New York during Mardi Gras, who were there to kind of consume the exotic, or to their mind, exotic, fun, day of revelry that is Mardi Gras in our cultural imagination, especially since we know that the strain, well, now we know the strain that of COVID that caused this huge spike in New Orleans was from New York. You can kind of trace that it was people from New York who were bringing coronavirus to New Orleans and causing this big spike. But we don't have space in our kind of public discourse to talk about other reasons for why things have gotten kind of bad in the South with coronavirus. It seems like the ready-made language to pick up is this sense that, well, it was always going to be bad. And it struck me how often at the very beginning, people wanted to compare what was happening in New Orleans to Hurricane Katrina. Mm. And that's part of why I quoted my mom in that chapter, because her first response to that was, this is nothing like Hurricane Katrina. But I argued in that the conclusion that people were reaching for Hurricane Katrina to talk about it, because there is this overwhelming norm to talk about Black life in terms of sorrow and tragedy. So, of course, it was inevitable that it was going to be horrific, and that we have to say it's like Hurricane Katrina if we want the federal response to be one of help and not just ignoring us. It seems like in order to get the sort of resources that we need to make this better, we have to appeal to how much we're suffering.
Yeah, and you do this thing where it felt anthropological in the way that Hurston and Simpson do this. Mm. Where you attend to how Black joy, practices of Black joy, people adapt them to the situation, right? People immediately begin, upon getting the information they need, begin to adapt things like their Mardi Gras celebrations to the situation. And you give this sort of, you give us this account of these adaptations being made in real time.
Yeah, one of the things that I kind of listened to on repeat during the early days of the pandemic was this song by Shamar Allen that I mentioned in the conclusion, where he sings about, you know, bringing a second line to your living room, and it was just so beautiful and captured this sense of, okay, this tradition of second lining is really important to us. It lifts our spirits, but clearly we can't just crowd in the street right now, given this horrible spike. So what do we do? In that video, he shows, you know, lots of people doing the second line dances in their living room. Yeah. And he also, in a very cheeky way, is reminding people about, you know, the tips that the CDC gives, like wear your mask and all those sorts of things. So you can kind of see with that we're not against adapting to the situation. And it's not our practices of joy that is making coronavirus as bad as it is in certain parts of the South. It was also heartening last year to see that. This year, the years just blend together with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But this year, instead of parades for Mardi Gras, a lot of people decorated their houses as floats, and you could just kind of drive around and see the different houses. We still want to have our celebration, but it's clear that we can't, as we did before. We have to adapt.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are you working on now?
So now what I'm doing is developing more of the stuff with root work. So I got connected with these two scholars, Kenitra Brooks and Camila Martin, who are developing this thing that they call conjure feminism, where they're trying to tease out the philosophical aspects of root work and conjure. They recently, I think it's out, it's either out or about to come out. They edited this special issue of Hypatia that's dedicated to conjure feminism. So a lot of what I'm doing is in line with that sort of work. I'm also early days working on a project that deals with refusal and root work and conjure women. And I'm looking at figures like Marie Laveau, who were alive during multiple endemics like yellow fever and cholera, and trying to figure out what resources these conjure women had that helped them get through pandemics.
Yeah.
Of course, this feels like everybody's thinking about pandemics right now, but I think rightfully so. This is the first time that it feels to me, at least in my lifetime, that society just shut down and stopped.
Yeah.
So I'm really kind of interested in how did so many Black women, Black conjure women, make it through that?
Oh, I'm really looking forward to that project.
Thanks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Lindsay Stewart, thank you again so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.